Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Gamble on, fellas. Gamble on.
Welcome again to Gamble On, the weekly gambling podcast presented by USBets.com. I'm Eric Raskin, USBets Managing Editor and Media Director, and I'm joined by our senior analyst, Pulitzer Prize finalist, John Brennan. And John, being a Pulitzer Prize finalist is one thing, but your greatest achievement came this week when you took the initiative to drop a note in the company Slack asking if there's a company-wide March Madness pool, and the boss said, no, there isn't, but there should be. And he decided our parent company, Better Collective, would host a $1,000 free roll. Well done, John. I must say, there are benefits to working for a company in the sports betting space. But I have to know, John, were you honestly looking to pay 10 bucks or 20 bucks or whatever to enter an office pool? Or were you using Jedi mind tricks here, thinking if you innocently threw the idea out there, the company would likely put up cash?
Yeah, I wish I was that smart. And really, you know, $5 was always my limit over the years in these pools. But I guess adjusting for inflation, 10, I think I might have gone for that. 20, a little rich for my blood, I think. But I'll tell you, it's funny that you mentioned your twinning March Madness and Pulitzers, though, because I've never told anybody this story. But since you stumbled into it, I will.
Okay.
So it was one early April day in 2008, and four of us in the newsroom are informed a few minutes beforehand that, by the way, that 18-month investigative work you did, that's going to be announced in a couple minutes as a finalist for a Pulitzer for local reporting. Now, Eric, I know your brother works in Hollywood and there are five nominees per category. Well, the Pulitzer folks only do three. So a winner and two runners up, not four. So I guess it's a big deal. But the other three guys are in kind of a frenzy. Well, I want the old Barry Sanders model of, you know, if you score a touchdown, you hand the ball to the referee and act like you've been there before and right. All that, even if you haven't. So when the news goes out, I go back to my desk at work and my colleagues are a little confused, particularly because unlike almost all the winning and finalist announcements over the years, ours had three specific names, including mine, not, you know, the staff of the New York Times or whatever. So that kind of threw them off. Well, anyway, I get home that night to watch the March Madness championship game in large part because I was one of only two out of about 80 or so entrants in the office pool who still had a chance to win. And the other guy was a legendary New York Giants writer for us, who even crusty coach Bill Parcells called Sage for his wisdom on the beat. Now, this is an eerie foreshadowing in retrospect. I told Vinny, look, I'd never risk $240, which was the first prize on one sporting event, and I doubt you would either. So I sent him some options. You know, we can just collect 120 each and no need to even watch the game. We can go 160 versus 80, 180 versus 60, right. 200 versus 40, that sort of thing. So he takes the latter offer, meaning I'm guaranteed eight times my original investment, no matter what happens. So that's not bad. And I got some skin in the game for sure. Well, this happens to be the Memphis-Kansas final, and Memphis was coached by John Calipari, whose entire ill-fated Nets career in New Jersey I had covered. So I knew him quite well, and I figured maybe that was a good omen. So Memphis, I think, grabbed a 9-point lead or so, maybe 10, with about 2 minutes left. And I think I've got my $200 extra, too. And Memphis misses four or five free throws. Kansas hits a 3-pointer to force overtime. They win it in OT. And I asked Vinny the next day, you know, how close did you come to turning off the TV? And he goes, one more possession. I was like, I figured that's what I was thinking. I just need one more possession. He knew it well. So then I soon found out that one of the bosses, I think the statute of limitations has expired on this, so I can tell this part. He asked around whether we had come really close to winning that Pulitzer or just kind of a runner-up, distant second. And he's told, you were as close as you can possibly come without winning. Which was funny because that sounds a lot like the Memphis-Kansas game that same day. So people have told me how disappointed they would be, you know, in my shoes. And for me, I said, listen, there's three prizes for each, right? If you want to weep for somebody, think about the poor bastards who came in fourth for the Pulitzer and got nothing to show for their great efforts, and fourth in the pool for the same sort of effort. Not exactly the same. You know, the poet Robert Browning once wrote, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? you know, it makes me think of getting a 190-yard hole-in-one back in 1995. It took me years to realize it, but right after that, I started playing less and less golf. I mean, there are a variety of reasons for that, but I think in part, in my subconscious, my work was done there, which is kind of a shame. So maybe it's better to come oh so close instead, and then you keep striving. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, I guess I hope I don't win that top prize in our office pool. I've never won one.
Right. Okay. Yep. I thought you were at a reasonable level of humble brag throughout all of that until you needlessly worked in. I hit a hole in one in golf once. That was when you went over the limit, unacceptable number of humble brags in a single story. But
yeah, I guess it's relevant. But I see your point.
I've won one March Madness pool in my life, and it was so long ago I barely remember it. But that year. As with this year, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I've watched zero college basketball games this year. So that means I'm going to win this pool. Apologies in advance to all the other entrants in the company pool. But I made all of my picks in about 3 minutes. I put almost no thought into it. So the top prize is mine. There's almost no need to play it out at this point.
I pretty much did the same, so we might be
okay. We could be neck and neck. I will say though, this is now your responsibility within the company, John, to do this every so often. Like next year, hey, do we have a Super Bowl company box pool going? Put that in the Slack. See if we get a free roll on that. I'm counting on you to keep asking the question, so the company keeps handing out money. Especially since, as I said, I am guaranteed to take first place in this thing.
Well, the baseball season's almost starting, so I think some kind of a futures pool. You know, when we could do. You pick over-unders on, you know, everybody picks five, something like that. Something, you know, kind of keep it sporting.
All right. We'll workshop it. We don't want to overdo it. If you ask too often, they might catch on to you. But, you know, once in a while, I think we can get these free rolls going. Thank you to everyone for joining us for episode number 134 of Gamble On. If you missed any of our previous 133 episodes, they're all available on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Please subscribe, rate, and review. It's the least you could do for this weekly audio entertainment free roll that we provide.
Yeah, and coming up a little later on the show, we're going to be joined by our U.S. Bets colleague, Chris Altruda. He's live on the scene in Indianapolis covering March Madness for us. And he'll let us know whether he likes Gonzaga, that's the correct pronunciation, Baylor, also the same, or a sleeper, how much impact he expects COVID to have, and what the atmosphere is going to be like on the streets and at the sports books in Indiana, does he think. But first, it's been a reasonably busy week in the world of gambling. So let's get to it.
Here's your Gamble On News of the Week, an inside look at the biggest stories in the world of gambling.
As John just said, Chris will be joining us shortly to talk March Madness, but we'll kick off the news segment with a little March Madness betting talk of our own. Twice a year, the American Gaming Association releases data projecting the legal and illegal betting action on an event. One is the Super Bowl, the other is March Madness. According to the AGA's surveys and research, 47 million Americans plan to wager money on the tournament, which is about the same number as 2 years ago, but the how has changed. Office pool participation is expected to be down about 8% from 2019 on account of many offices being closed and worker interaction being greatly diminished. But the number of Americans expecting to place a bet on the tournament is way up, from 17.8 million 2 years ago to 30.6 million now. And the number planning to place such a bet online is up a whopping 206% over 2 years ago. John, any surprise that some people aren't finding virtual ways to join a pool this year? I mean, honestly, I can't remember the last time I filled out a pool on paper by hand anyway. And what are your thoughts on the ways in which wagering on March Madness is changing and how the gap in social acceptability is closing between bracket pool participation and Vegas-style sports betting?
Well, you know, I was still filling out a paper ballot for this maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and it was a lot of work for the pool handler, but it seemed like it was kind of fun for him, I think. Also an older fellow. Right. You know, I mentioned in passing in my 10th annual filling out a competent March Madness bracket without having watched college basketball filing that posted on Wednesday on sportshandle.com. You know, one of the fun parts used to be seeing the standings sent around the office, and, you know, you mosey over to the desk of a surprise contender after two rounds and sort of congratulate them, or even better, you go to the desk of the college hoops Sports know-it-all whose bracket is bleeding from every orifice. That's a great great time. And right. You can't do that virtually. The guy's probably not going to accept the Zoom invitation if you want to do it that way. You know, you can just ambush him when he's sitting right at his desk. But the Zoom, he's got to sign off on that. So you lose a little bit of that. So it's like the difference between winning $5,000 at a casino table game and having random people celebrate with you and doing it online in your pajamas. So I mean, I would think some casual potential entrants were sure to drop off. So that doesn't surprise me. I think as far as legal gambling awareness, the bulk of Americans don't quite get it and don't quite care. Bracket contest is a one-time minor hit to their bankroll. And if they don't know how to fill out a sensible bracket, they're probably not going to win. I mean, one of them, as you say, tends to win, but the rest of them don't even contend and they don't care. So awareness is way up, relatively speaking. But, we have to remember in this industry that, if you take 5 or 10 random people at the local mall, if it ever reopens or they reopen, I don't even know, a lot of them are going to say, yeah, I've never gambled in my life. So it's not for everybody anyway. And even making it legal in so many states, yes, it's going to increase the participation, but it's not like everybody's going to be doing it.
Yeah. So as far as that drop off in people entering the office pools, I think you're absolutely right that the social element being out of it accounts for a lot of that. I mean, if you actually want to enter a March Madness pool, if you're willing to put in 3 seconds of effort to find one, they're more readily available than ever, regardless of whether you're in an office. So yeah, that 8% basically represents the people who never cared about entering the office pool, but the papers came around and they said, what the hell, it's $5 and filled one out. So that's what the survey tells me, that about 8% of the people who always participated in the office pool were doing so purely to be sociable and to participate, but didn't actually care at all. But yeah, honestly, I wasn't going to enter any pools this year until you got us that free roll. But I was always expecting to bet, despite knowing next to nothing about the teams. I currently have 7 bets on the tournament. I'm sure that number will go up significantly as it goes along. They're all just based on hearing something on a podcast or reading something and thinking, that sounds like a good bet. So I make it and give myself a reason to watch a few of the games, or at least the last 2 minutes of a few of the games. But I will say, in terms of that social acceptability, it actually seems to me, based on the limited real social interaction that I've had over the past year, that anybody who uses the legal betting sites isn't shy about mentioning the bets they have. I have people bringing it up to me all the time now. So I think it's almost as unstigmatized right now as fantasy football, at least, in the states where it's legal and has been for a little while. And I think that's part of why states that launch sports betting now come out swinging with big numbers right from the jump, instead of having to ramp up slowly the first few months, the way New Jersey did a couple of years ago. When betting comes to a new state, people are ready for it and not feeling like there's anything wrong with opening an account and getting started. And certainly March Madness is a time of year where it's particularly acceptable to be open about that stuff.
Yeah, I'll just add that I think that people talking about their fantasy football teams, I think that behavior should be stigmatized. That's my
favorite. That's fair. I agree with that.
I think particularly because, I am an online fantasy baseball player, although I don't tell many people about it. But, that's chess compared with an auction, no less. That's chess compared to checkers that so many fantasy football players have played. And they've got the ESPN.com thing up. They got auto pick going. And then they're saying, oh, I've got this guy at running back. Like, you didn't even pick the damn guy, much less bid on him, God forbid. You go up the ladder and have to make a split second decision on whether to go big on that guy and then spend a lot of your bankroll and then hold back. And, it's so much more complicated. So if I'm not going to talk about my fantasy baseball team, this being one exception here, I sure as hell don't want to hear about your fantasy football team.
Look at you looking down your nose at the common fantasy football player. You're such a fantasy season long elitist, John.
Yeah, I'm really on a roll here, aren't I?
All right, let's move on to our second story. Revenue reports for February are out in several states, including 3 particularly notable ones: New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, all of which were released on Tuesday. One thing is clear: a short month with only one football game isn't going to set any sports betting records. In New Jersey, although this would have been a single month record about 6 months ago, betting handle dropped from $958.7 million in January to only $743 million in February, resulting in a modest $46.2 million in revenue. The house won about twice as much from online casino as from sports betting, with about $91.3 million in revenue from mobile slots and table games, plus about another $2.5 million in online poker rake. In Pennsylvania, sports betting handle took a similar decline, falling 17.2% from January to $509.5 million, with revenue of just $16.4 million. Thanks to thriving iCasino gaming, though, overall gaming revenue in the state was almost identical to February 2020, despite the COVID limitations on brick-and-mortar casinos. In Michigan, unlike in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, sports betting handle was way up in February, but that's because this was the first full month of online wagering. Total handle in Michigan was $301.9 million, with FanDuel, BetMGM, and DraftKings all fairly tightly bunched at the top. However, after promotional money was taken into account, only BetMGM and William Hill showed a profit for the month. Meanwhile, online casino is thriving in Michigan with $79 million in revenue for the month, slightly higher already than Pennsylvania. John, thoughts on any of these numbers? And do you have an early prediction on whether New Jersey is crossing the $1 billion mark in March?
The Michigan beating Pennsylvania and noting the profitability or lack thereof for those sites, I think in general that talks to a massive, massive marketing pitch in Michigan that for whatever reason hasn't taken place quite as much in Pennsylvania, even though it has good competition there too. And I am sending Jersey over 1 billion in March, Eric. Without football, it's no lock, but March Madness betting will be insane. NBA and even the NHL are ramping up their regular seasons, and MLB futures bets ought to do quite well in the last week or two of March, I think. You know, I was bearish on the February numbers and I hit that forecast. So yep. I feel a little feisty on this one. And in general, there's a lot of gaming industry chatter on whether those massive amounts of easy win marketing efforts are such a good idea that we're seeing in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and elsewhere. But I think it's like dog eat dog to eat filet mignon. So I get it. There's big money to be had. Now, if Michigan State can only come within 110 points of UCLA in that play-in game, I win almost $50. And the free $130 I got for signing up with another site this week goes up by 40 more if St. Bonaventure wins the first round game. So it's quite the buyer's market for cheap bastards like ourselves, Eric.
Yes, indeed. I'm right with you on the $1 billion question. I'd be pretty shocked, actually, if New Jersey doesn't cross $1 billion in March. And I'm on record saying that I think nationally, where the record is $4.3 billion in handle in January, I think $5 billion is in reach for March. I'd set the line at $4.8 billion. So obviously we don't need to overshoot that by much to hit $5 billion. I think it's possible. You're absolutely right about that online casino number in Michigan. It's the marketing, and it might seem surprising at first glance that Michigan would be ahead of Pennsylvania already, but again, there's no real ramp up period anymore. These states, everyone knows online gaming is coming. It's built for many months before it finally launches. So they're able to dive right in. These promotional payouts are probably the most interesting part of all this. They're heaviest when a site is new. They tend to slow down after a month or two because the sports books are just so much of what they do is these welcome offers. So once you've signed up once, you've gotten the biggest bang for your buck, you know, whether it's the $500 free bet or bet $500, get $500. Most of them have something in that realm. And people sign up and take advantage, and clearly bettors are plus EV during the opening period. So I think that's mostly a month one and two kind of phenomenon in Michigan. By March, most of the sports books should be profitable, and certainly by April, I think the operators will be showing a standard hold. There are still odds boosts and promos here and there to win over customers, like the one you talked about with that 100 plus point spread. Those things still pop up, but nothing as big as bet $500, and if you lose, we'll just give your $500 right back to you.
Yeah, I'm a little jealous of the retired folks, though, because they've got a lot of time in their hands. And as you say, some of these offers come up, you may not notice them, and you kind of got to keep your eye out for everything. And you read the fine print, although for the most part, I haven't seen any, fine print disaster stories. They're pretty straightforward. But, you have to make sure that the bonus is in the bet before you click it and that sort of thing. So, it takes a little bit of care. But again, if you're retired, you got all the time in the world, or so I'm told.
Yeah, I'm jealous of the retired people for other reasons. I just... I just want to get out of the rat race, but I'm not that close to it yet, I don't think. So, all right. For our third story, New Jersey and Pennsylvania are part of our third story this week as well, along with Nevada, as we're going to discuss easing of casino restrictions. In Nevada, capacity limits went up on Monday from 35% to 50%. And the Las Vegas Review-Journal reported that there were shoulder-to-shoulder crowds on the Strip, although at least masks were apparently being worn and casino employees were enforcing that requirement. So Vegas might be looking and feeling like Vegas, for better or for worse, when March Madness tips off. In New Jersey, casinos will go up to 50% capacity on Friday in time for, well, not the first four, but the traditional 64-team bracket. And also the 10 p.m. curfew on food and drink will end as casinos will go back to 24-hour service. In Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Wolf announced on Monday that starting April 4th, casinos in the state will be allowed to serve alcohol as normal instead of only to people sitting down and eating meals at the property's restaurants. Also, casino capacity will increase from 50% to 75% at that time. It's a fine line between opening up too soon and opening up appropriately as the vaccine distribution increases. John, do any of these states have you concerned with regard to their pace? Are any of them moving more quickly or more slowly than you might have expected? And is Pennsylvania making a mistake by not timing their loosening of restrictions to coincide with March Madness?
Well, I'll start with the latter question, which actually kind of a hard one. My first inclination is that's a mistake, because why hamper the casino revenue streams and state tax revenue like that? But we've both taken a fairly cautious stance in general, I think, on all this stuff in the past year, which was not a bad idea, but more ambitious rollouts seem to have worked out mostly okay, especially in the last several months. Bottom line, let's remember, casinos are the most heavily regulated and scrutinized industries in many states, maybe to a fault. An outbreak at their casino, or even the perception of it, is very, very bad for business. Many casinos in Atlantic City, Las Vegas, and no doubt all over the country have spent millions of dollars on making their ventilation systems COVID resistant, more so than almost anywhere else that someone might visit during the course of a week. So it's still a little scary to me, but you know, here we go. I saw some middle-aged news anchors the other day looking at the beaches in South Florida, all the people there, and literally saying they were terrified of what might happen. You know, in spite of the growing recognition that being outdoors goes a long, long way to reducing infection rates.
Right.
Still smartest to also socially distance and wear a mask or two. But we've learned a couple of things in the last year, and I don't know why people want to ignore it. And let's be honest, the average 22-year-old, I'm not saying they could take a bath in COVID-19 droplets and walk out without ever getting a sniffle, but
right.
I'm not saying they can't, or a lot of them can't. And that's the idea. Well, the risk is non-zero, even for them. You know, there's just one case in Wisconsin, I think. The person was 25. Yeah, that's true. But young people take risks, a lot of risks, and a small number of them die. And it's always been the case. And, it's like these people were never young. They never went to a frat party. They never did all kinds of stupid things that I'm not going to talk about. You know, and then the real concern is, what about grandma or grandpa, right? Okay, they're going to be fine. They can pass it on to somebody who's very vulnerable. That's a serious issue. Well, at this point, the odds that grandma or grandpa have been vaccinated is pretty decent, and that's going to go a long way to keeping them safe. So it's happening, and let's hope for the best. Meanwhile, I should note that even though I'm months away from my 60th birthday, I technically qualify for a vaccine because my BMI is over 25, body mass index. You know, the CDC has included that a 6-foot male should weigh between, wait for it, 136 and 184 pounds. Otherwise, you're overweight. Now, I grew a foot and an inch in high school, and at about 20 years old, I was 6 foot, 145 pounds. And I looked, to be honest, to be an inspiring figure for having battled through what appears to have been a very serious recent illness and still, hanging in there. You know, narrator John weighs more than 184 pounds. Not a ton more, but I don't have to make weight like a high school wrestler to qualify either. But I've never had a flu shot. I've never had the flu. I've never missed a day of work in my life due to illness so far, knock on wood. So I'll wait my turn.
All right. Well, hopefully your turn is coming soon, because this is one quote unquote flu shot that you want to go ahead and get.
Oh, I'll take it. I'm yep. online for it. And my twin actually just got approved this morning. So
all right.
If we're identical, I think that would cover me also.
Does him getting the shot? Is there some osmosis that you're vaccinated as well just by him getting the shot?
I think that's just identical twins. I don't think fraternal twins qualify there, okay. But it doesn't hurt. That's for sure.
Right. All right. the whole Vegas thing, there will be some spread of the virus this week in Vegas. It is unavoidable under these circumstances, but you keyed on it that hopefully it's young, healthy people spreading it. And then they're all going to avoid visiting unvaccinated grandparents for a couple of weeks after they get home. Although I'm not convinced all of those people are quite that responsible and taking the virus seriously. So, you know, Vegas is problematic to some degree, but it sounds like guidelines are being followed better than in the late spring when Vegas became like a real hub for infection. And certainly the vaccines help minimize the risk everywhere. You know, New Jersey, the degree to which they're opening up, that sounds fine. Murphy has been, if anything, overly conservative at times with opening up. New Jersey and Pennsylvania are both making decent progress on vaccination, which I think is key here. You know, there are some states where like 5% of adults have been vaccinated so far, you haven't really reduced the danger of gathering. But in states where you're getting to 20, 25% have had at least one shot, it starts to make a difference. That said, that the 75% capacity in Pennsylvania a couple of weeks from now, that sounds like kind of a lot. That's a crowded casino on a Saturday night. So that's maybe the only thing that I'd object to here. I'd prefer they stay at 50% and, you know, one more month down the road, you get to early May. By then, almost every adult in Pennsylvania who needs the vaccine will have gotten the vaccine. Then maybe you go to 75%. But again, you said we've both been pretty conservative about all of this. Maybe I'm being a little overly conservative there. I will say, at least, I'm glad there aren't any casinos in Texas. That would be a particular shit show, casinos in a state where the mask mandates are being thrown out.
Yeah, well, you know, we have to give people some level of credit, too. I mean, a number of the people that are going to show up are ones that have been vaccinated.
Right.
Others that, you know, found out they had it and they're probably can't get it again, not 100%, but likely. And also, I think we sometimes at this point, we're being a little condescending to grandma and grandpa. But because not only that, the grandkids shouldn't necessarily visit them after a bender in Vegas, but you know, grandma and grandpa, they can lock the door, close the drapes, and the grandson's knocking on the door and they pretend they're not home. I mean, they don't have to let somebody in. You know, they have a power of agency in most cases. Obviously there are exceptions for some very, very elderly people, but you know, so they know what the drill is. Hopefully the grandsons and granddaughters also know. So I think if they go, they're probably fine. And I think that either the young people or the old people are going to be sensible enough not to start mingling 3 days later. So that's why I think it's going to be all right in the end.
Yeah, I hear you. But as a parent with kids and thus with parents and therefore grandparents in the picture, I'll just say it's hard to overstate the lure for a grandparent of hugging their grandkids. This has been a tough year for them and trying to find ways around it. And actually, I'll just note that my mom and both of my in-laws have gotten both of their shots at this point. So so we are entering the category where hugs are pretty safe. So that's good. But, you know, I would just say I don't necessarily think it's easy for grandparents to shut the drapes and not open the door when the grandkids come around.
Well, you're thinking of a younger kid. I'm thinking of a 25-year-old right. with a, you know, he's got long hair, incredible level of stubble from a lost weekend. He's, you know, he's mumbling to himself and his clothes are disheveled. I mean, that's not I don't think grandma's is desperate to give that kid a hug.
You might be right. It's true that my 11-year-old son is not partying in Vegas this week.
Right. Just wait, though.
It's time to welcome a special guest from the world of gambling. Let's get to the Gamble On interview.
There was plenty of madness in March of 2020, but none of the traditional capital M March Madness we look forward to. But this week, for the first time in more than 700 days, March Madness is here. And US Bets has a man on the scene in Indiana covering the betting as well as attending actual tournament games. And he is our Chicago-based correspondent, Chris Altruda. Chris, thanks for joining us again on Gamble On.
Hey, happy to be on.
So the tournament is happening, but it's not clear whether all 67 games will happen as the possibility of COVID cancellations is looming. I'm curious how you think that should impact the approach to betting. Are people more likely to play it safe and bet game by game instead of making futures bets? Would you personally shy away from a bet on one of the favorites to reach the Final Four or win it all just because of the additional uncertainty possibly opening the door for underdogs? What's your take on all that?
I think the two teams that have the potential to be most affected are Kansas and Virginia. And while I like Virginia a little bit, I also think that they're in a region with Gonzaga, which is the 900-pound gorilla of the tournament. Mm-hmm. I don't think bettors are going to shy away from betting on Gonzaga as a future. I mean, you're not going to get great value for that pick because they are the number one overall seed, but I don't see bettors shying away from anyone around that region. I mean, you may hold off more on Virginia than Kansas because I think Virginia's plan is to pretty much just fly in the morning of the game and play the game, which right. is borderline bonkers. And Kansas, you know, Kansas has an NCAA tournament history of flaming out without the help of COVID. So, you know, that's one of the things you can just kind of like look at and say, yeah, you might want to save your money and bet somewhere else with them. But I don't think it should matter to bettors. I mean, I think if you're committed to that pick, you're going to make that pick.
Right. So other than the teams that are already having some COVID issues, you're saying for everyone else, you would say, yes, the faint possibility exists, but not it's faint enough that it wouldn't impact your approach to who you're picking to go deep in the tournament.
Right. Because I don't think it would affect more than one game in a sub-region. I don't think a team is going to get two walkovers in a same sub-region to advance to a regional semifinal. So no, I don't think it should affect that type of betting.
Gotcha.
All right. You know, Chris, you live in Big Ten country, and obviously that conference supposedly is an absolute, you know, behemoth this season. But doesn't mostly that come from playing each other? I mean, Illinois lost by 13 to Baylor in December, I see, and they only beat Ohio University by two. I mean, the Bobcats are in the tournament, but still. So is there any chance that the Big Ten is wildly overrated this season, or are you sold on them?
I'm not overly sold on them. I think the committee had a thankless job this year because two of the Power Five conferences, because you look at the Big East and the Pac-12, they didn't have that dominant team. Even like Villanova, you know, once Colin Gillespie went down, they are still, in my opinion, somewhat overseeded as a five. And the Pac-12 had the same issues with Colorado. Like no one stood up the way the Big Ten had four really good teams this year. Ohio State was probably the biggest surprise of the bunch. But I think Illinois and Michigan were definitely justified in their one. I'm not completely sold on Iowa because they just don't play defense. And while they have the offensive talent to outscore you 100-90, at some point someone's going to stand up to them. And I don't know whether or not they can actually hold down the fort defensively. But I think that it's so top heavy that it's going to be very hard to knock them off that perch. I don't think it's an overrated per se. I just think that second tier has to deliver first and second round wins to justify all nine of them being as highly touted as they are.
Right. I guess I should follow up since it's been 30 years since Rutgers was in the tournament. They're a 10 seed playing. They're a 10 seed playing in the seven seed against the seven seed Clemson, and Rutgers is a slight favorite. So I mean, they got crushed by Nebraska a couple of weeks ago. Are they just tough to figure? Is there something about them that might get them a little bit of a run here?
I think they actually got a really good draw. I think they're an offensively flawed team, but that's been the case since Pickle took over because he stressed defense first. They, you know, Clemson's in somewhat of a mirror image. I mean, Clemson does not scare anyone with their athleticism, and you know, Houston is a very good defensive team, but Rutgers is comfortable playing a rock fight game like that. I don't think you're going to beat Houston, but at the same time, you know, if you're playing to 60, you have a chance because that's what you've been doing all season.
All right. Well, Rutgers certainly, if they were to go on a run, it would be a Cinderella story, and one of the deepest of sleepers. So it's a nice transition into the next topic, because you've written a series of articles on US Bets, Chris, about sleeper picks to win it all. Now that we've seen the bracket and the title odds for every team, who is your favorite sleeper bet? And I know you were defining a sleeper as pretty much any team other than Gonzaga and Baylor. So outside those top two, which team do you think has the best value to go all the way?
I think it's Florida State. And in some respects, they gained value by being put as a four seed. The odds came longer to him. I believe that there was, it was plus 4,000 in some places for them.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at right now. Yep.
It's a team that even before last year, they were arguably a better team defensively, but it's a team that also got to the second weekend each of the prior two NCAA tournaments. It's a team that's long. I mean, they have NBA size. And in a one-and-done setting, when you have to turn around and play someone on an off day, on short rest, yes, you have advanced scouting, but that's hard at the college level to play against. It's a big team. It's a long team. They play defense. And this year, Florida State specifically has a better offense. It has more sources on the perimeter. It's not an imbalanced team where they rely on one sharpshooter from the outside. They have three guys you have to respect, and the ball moves. And also their freshman, whose name escapes me at the moment, does a little bit of everything. He facilitates the offense. He plays good defense. He might be the person who winds up carrying that team to the Final Four. And if they get there, it's two more games at that point.
Okay. Yeah. I had them penciled in as a possible. I was just looking at the bracket, and they did seem like at least a good shot for one, picking a non-number one seed to go to the Final Four. They stood out as one of the good options there. I've also seen some of the books have a special bet on just either Gonzaga or Baylor to win it all versus the field. And I'm seeing the Gonzaga Baylor side at like just better than even money, like plus 110. Does that appeal to you, or are they not really better than 50-50 that one of those teams is going to win it?
I think they are. I think it is better than 50-50 because I think Gonzaga is that good. I mean, okay. The parallel I keep coming up with for Gonzaga is they're the offensive version of the 1990 UNLV team. Yeah, that team just suffocated teams defensively. This team will suffocate you offensively because you're so desperate to keep up with them that they're just going to spin you faster. And very few teams can keep up with them. I mean, Iowa did to a little bit of an extent. Virginia got absolutely smoked in December when they played them. Kansas, they toyed with Kansas for most of that game too. So it's going to be very hard to knock off Gonzaga. I mean, it's almost going to take like that the Duke UNLV game from 91 where they have to be at the top of their game to take them down.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
And Chris, if you see the headlines in the news this week, tons of people are going to Las Vegas for March Madness as if, all is right with the world. They're in Miami for spring break. The beaches are full. But I've spent a lot of time in Indianapolis where you're headed. And as a former New York Daily News sports columnist, Mark Kriegel, he wrote back in the 1990s, "It tells you all you need to know about this city, that the place with the most action on a Saturday night is a Steak and Shake." So I was there one Memorial Day weekend, a Knicks Pacers Saturday afternoon, Monday afternoon. So Sunday night is going to be hopping, right? They folded up the sidewalks around 9 p.m. So on the one hand, I'm wondering what you expect in terms of the vibe of the city downtown on the evenings. But then also inside, I mean, the one thing they did have was, lively fans, obviously, for Pacers playoff games. But and they're pretty rapidly in love with college basketball, but they're not going to be there for the most part. So is this going to be feel like March Madness, March Blandness, something in between?
It's a very curious thing because, but I'm going to the Cal Santa Barbara Creighton game on Saturday. And they started, when you get the ticket, they start telling you all the precautions you're going to take. You have to wear the mask at all times. And then the little things like food is going to be pre-made. They're going to be pre-packaged. You're not going to allow to linger on the concourse. So, the NCAA has, kudos to them to getting to this point. And, it's a no-win situation for them when it comes to the aesthetics. I mean, like when you read it, it sort of sounds like the fire festival, of bland cheese sandwiches along those lines. So you don't exactly know how it's going to play out. But I also think with this being the first time you can wager in a state outside of Nevada for the NCAA tournament, New Jersey granted the exception, I think the atmosphere is going to be different. I mean, on Thursday, I'm going to head over to the Winner Circle, which is the OTB version of Indianapolis, to watch the first four there and see how it plays out. I think the casinos, the nearest casino is Hollywood Lawrenceburg, and that casino has done amazingly well in terms of sports betting handle. It generated eight figures, which I'm not exactly sure what, if it's back at 100% capacity, but even so, that's still an impressive number. I mean, Illinois as an entirety did not generate $10 billion in retail sports betting handle in January. So I think there's different things that go on, how it plays out. I mean, it really is a big mystery. And, you know, even walking for, you know, with the games that are going to be at Hinkle and IUPUI and, you know, walking back and forth from them, I also don't know what the spring break schedule is like. So those campuses could be, you know, deserted. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And, you know, downtown will be downtown. I'm sure there'll be something to do. Even if it is Indianapolis, I'm sure downtown Indianapolis has something to offer.
Well, not just Indianapolis, but in Indianapolis during COVID, we'll see right. just how tamped down it is. But when you're at the game, are you planning to attempt some in-game wagering where there's absolutely no chance of a delay in terms of you knowing what's going on in the game?
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely going to happen. I mean, if for no other reason, it's almost a professional requirement to do it just as a testing ground right. to see what it is, and also make sure there's no geofencing around any of these venues.
Right.
So because that was one of the things, because we didn't know by choosing campus sites, we didn't know whether or not there was any sort of rules that the NCAA conceivably could have asked the gaming commission to put a geofence up, but no one said whether or not they did. No one confirmed they didn't. So it'll be something to possibly look out for and see if it happens at Mackey or Assembly Hall or Hinkle.
All right. Great stuff. Well, we appreciate you coming on the podcast to talk about all this with us, Chris. Enjoy the tournament in Indianapolis, and fingers crossed for your in-game bets, your pre-game bets, and of course for negative COVID tests for all teams.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it as always.
Two men. $10,000. Will they run it up or blow it all? It's time to check in on the Gamble On Bankroll.
When we end a winning streak, we end it emphatically. After five straight positive weeks for the bankroll, we put up an over last week, whiffing on all of our bets. First, over 16.5 points on Shake Milton missed, as he only scored 10 on a lousy shooting night. That cost us $100. Then John's bet on Adam Scott for the top 20 was looking decent through Friday, but unraveled on Saturday. That cost us another $100. And I went 0-for-3 with my boxing bets, two of which were long shots, but one of which was a favorite. Cecilia Brakus lost to Jessica McCaskill. We dropped $75 on that. Gachet versus Clark to end in a draw was a terrible call. Gachet stopped him in two rounds. And then my other draw pick was the heartbreaker. Chocolatito Gonzalez and Juan Francisco Estrada went all 12 rounds in the most entertaining sporting event I've watched in 2021. To anyone listening out there with even a casual interest in boxing, seek out this fight. Just remarkable skill and determination on display. But anyway, it was razor close and hard to score. All the elements were there for a draw. But Estrada took a split decision where if one judge had flipped one round from Estrada to Gonzalez, we would have gotten the draw at 18-1. So a bit of a tough beat. We lost $295 on the week, putting us down $906. Plus, we have $1,604 on hold in futures bets. So that leaves us with $7,490 available to bet with this week. And you're up first, John.
First, I'll just say oof. But, you know, glass is half full. I guess we're only down about $7 a week in a lifetime bankroll. Even after that bloodbath, that doesn't sound as bad. But
right.
Now, I'd like to bounce back with a golf pick, but the Honda Classic in Jupiter, Florida this week, the field is just brutal. The favorite, Daniel Berger, who's not quite a household name, he had to withdraw with a rib and back soreness. And it's just too brutal to bet. So I'm going to go back to Michigan State, who failed me a couple of weeks ago. I'm giving 2 points to UCLA. And I think I learned a little bit from my mistake previously against Michigan, where Michigan State was just exhausted in their first game on that the final 4 days. And so Michigan steamrolled in the second half. But then the second game, Michigan State came back and actually beat them. And I think that's more the real Michigan State team. And look, Tom Izzo in March Madness he's got something figured out with his players. So they're not a great team, but they're only playing UCLA. I'm not putting the Spartans in the Final Four or anything, but 110 to win 100 on Michigan State -2.
Okay. So at the top of the show, I talked about how I know nothing about college basketball. So, of course, I'm making college basketball bets this week. First, every year, 12 seeds do well against 5 seeds. There's always at least one 12 over five upset. Often there are two. In 2019, the last time we had one of these tournaments, there were three. And from what I can glean from listening to college basketball experts, each of this year's 12 seeds are legitimately live for one reason or another. So let's do a $50 money line bet on each of the 12 seeds at the best prices I could find. So that's $50 on Oregon State over Tennessee at +350 on DraftKings, $50 on Winthrop over depleted Villanova at +240 at BetMGM, $50 on streaking Georgetown over Colorado at +215 on DraftKings, and $50 on UCSB in the game Chris Altruda will be attending against Creighton at +265 on FanDuel. If one of them wins, we're in the vicinity of break even with the total $200 we're risking. If two win, we score a solid profit. If three win, like in 2019, we win big. And if all four win, I'll hate myself for not parlaying them.
Yeah, I like that. I got an odds boost on any of the four win at 12 seeds winning.
Yep, I saw that. Saw that and jumped on it myself. And by the way, I did look up what the parlay would pay just so we can have full regret if it does hit. Yeah. 144-1 is what we're not taking a shot on here, but I'm not going to do it. There's all four 12 seeds can't win.
I don't think so. But so now I'm going to go on a little bit of a limb of sorts for this next one. Not my style usually, but 100 on Gonzaga at +205, which is the best price I found. I've always shorted undefeated teams heading into the tournament, and I was all set to do so here again. But, you know, I got one of those silly promotions that nearly guaranteed me $50 or so if Gonzaga would merely win their conference tournament title game recently. They trailed by a dozen points in the second half, and I was like, uh-oh, I about to tune this in. And I watched a stretch run, and I saw a team that – for once all year facing a little adversity after having stomped so many, you know, supposedly daunting rivals. And they just embraced the challenge. They methodically caught up. They were still nearly even with 3 or 4 minutes left. And then they showed up another gear to win easily. And they sold me, Eric. They really sold me.
All right. So how much? So that's at +205 to win the tournament for how much?
Yeah. 100
+205. Okay. Yeah. All right. So Gonzaga, Nevada. Yeah. Same vowel sounds.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to try to remember there. Okay.
Yeah. Gonzaga is just north of Oregon, by the way.
Yeah. Right. Now, yeah, that one I know. Oregon, I learned that my first week in college. I met a guy from Oregon, and I think I said Oregon, and he corrected me, and I've never gotten it wrong since. But are you tipping your hand as to who you've picked to win it all in your company pool bracket?
Oh, I'm not going to comment on that. Okay. The picks aren't locked in yet. Who knows how many of our teammates are listening to?
Right. All right. All right. Fair enough. I'll find out in 24 hours or so. For my second set of bets, I'm keying on Oral Roberts University, the 15 seed in the South region. They face the 2 seed Ohio State. Oral Roberts is, as I learned on a podcast this week, a team that relies on the 3-pointer, doesn't play much defense, just run and gun. And if the shot is falling, they put up a lot of points. They scored 81.8 points per game this year while allowing 75.8. And Ohio State's right there with them, scoring 77 and allowing 70.3. The points total line is appropriately high at 156.5. But it's always fun to bet the over, right? So let's do 110 on that to win 100. And if the shots are indeed falling for Oral Roberts, the upset is in play. They're as high as a +1200 dog. So let's just go $20 to win 240 on that semi-rare 15-2 result. And that will do it for this episode of Gamble On. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. And thanks again to our guest, Chris Altruda. You can find me on Twitter at Eric Raskin and John at Bergen Brennan, and follow US Bets at US_bets. Go to usbets.com for all the latest news and analysis from the world of gambling, and subscribe to this podcast on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And with that, John, please take us out.
Well, you know, last week I explained how important 1985 was to March Madness. First time the field expanded to 64 teams. Every conference tournament champion around the country got a bid. My Fairleigh Dickinson University Knights came within a whisker of beating Michigan for what would have been the most shocking upset at the time in tournament history. And how Michigan's struggle might have contributed to their second round loss to Villanova a couple days later, and then the Wildcats' eventual epic title game win over Georgetown. But there was another aspect of 1985 that we alluded to earlier, and that's that 64-team bracket. It's a thing of beauty, really. Just look at it. Two sets of 16 teams, each on the left side, same on the right side. Each round, the winners advance closer and closer to the center and final battleground. It's a thing of beauty. But mankind has always been cursed with tinkering with perfection, and this was no different. So in 2001, with the arrival of the Mountain West Conference on the scene, another automatic bid was awarded. So Now, sensible people would have done the obvious. Okay, so that means one less at large bid. The borderline choices from power conferences who sometimes couldn't even win half their conference games anyway. And we got our 64. Now, the NCAA marches to its own drummer. And I really don't blame the guy who, in a stuffy office environment, proposed a dumbass idea that I guess we'll have to go to 65 teams and add a single playing game versus the two worst of conference champions. I mean, not at all. You blame the other people in the room who sat there silently, overlying this made no sense and yet doing nothing, and it got approved. But little harm was done, given that for 10 years, two bad teams face each other, and the winner was whacked by a number one seed each year, like an extra in a Sopranos episode. But then we get to 2011. Now the decision is made to have two play-in games featuring the four most borderline bubble boy teams. And once again, you know, all would cooperate by the winner losing rather handily in the main draw, right? So it's dumb but harmless, and, you know, what the heck. The other two games were designed really to let the teams decide, you know, who the last teams in should be. Why not let them decide it on the court? I don't think that's a crazy idea in principle. And, you know, it messed a little bit with the bracket and the look of it. But, you know, the hope was, again, that these are 11th or 12th seeds. They're just going to get bounced by the sixth seed, right? So, you know, you can pretty much ignore it when you fill out your bracket a couple days in advance. But in the first year, impudent Virginia Commonwealth refused to cooperate. They won the play-in game. They knocked off six-seeded Georgetown, third-seeded Purdue, 10-seeded Florida State, top-seeded Kansas, and they're in the Final Four. And this is a team that nobody even pretty much had listed in their bracket because they were right. Just a, you know, the bubble team. So that made that bracket a mess. And not just because the 11 seed made the Final Four, but because of that play-in aspect. So I thought maybe a reboot was in order. A 72 or 80 game bracket wasn't perfect either, but clearly a bubble team isn't guaranteed to be cannon fodder. They proved that. Then comes 2012, and it's a little calmer, but South Florida played in and won twice. LaSalle won three games in 2013, Tennessee three in 2014, Dayton two in 2015, Wichita State two in 2016, UCLA two in 2017, Syracuse won three times in 2018. So what the hell's wrong with all these six seeds? I think the problem is that the battle-hardened winner of a play-in game is just at an advantage against a six seed that, you know, kind of was good but not so great. So I think this hasn't worked out, and here we are. We're still at a dumb 68 teams. It's better than 65, maybe, but how about 80? I don't know. But you know what? It's March Madness. Bracket Madness isn't going away in spite of these imperfections, and I'm glad for that, especially after we missed out on 2020. So with that, finally, until next time, gamble on.